Today on Common Ground Radio, we're discussing how and why to save seeds, from annuals like your favorite heirloom tomato to the more complicated biennials like carrots and beets. Saving your own seed can be cost-effective and also allows you to select for traits specific to your tastes, such as sweetness, as well as gardening conditions and climate. I'm Holly Cederholm, your host for a conversation about local food and organic agriculture brought to you by the Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association on Community Radio WERU 89.9 FM Blue Hill. The following interview was recorded in 2024. In it, I speak with seed-saving legend Will Bonzel, author of Will Bonzel's Essential Guide to Radical Self-Reliant Gardening and the director of the Scatter Seed Project, a project dedicated to preserving thousands of genetically diverse crops well-suited to Maine seasons and soils.
Will, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Holly. Thanks for having me.
When did you first start saving seed and why?
Well, I started saving seed basically the year I bought my land, moved to the farm, and started gardening, because my whole obsession at that time was self-sufficiency in many respects, not merely growing my own food, but growing the seed for the food, growing the fertilizer for the food, and so on. And so even though my first garden was all seeds that came from commercial catalogs, I was determined that as soon as possible, I was going to keep growing those same varieties, but be saving my own seed. And that was long before I knew anything about rare, endangered heirloom seeds, just simply for the economics of it, being self-sufficient.
So you mentioned self-sufficiency and economics as two reasons to save seed. What are some of the other reasons that seed saving is important?
Well, some of them I didn't know at that time. But just for example, an elderly man here in town, he had a lot of stuff in his garden that was very interesting. Some of it that did not come from any commercial source. A lot of it was old varieties that local people kept going. One example being the cowhorn potato and a few other things like that, which were not available off the shelf, so to speak. And so I was very intrigued to find out there was a whole world of stuff out there that was not readily available to people, that was part of our heritage, family, community. And then that made me realize that if we're going to keep this stuff going, I can't go to the catalog every year. I have to save my own seeds. And also I found that some varieties that I grew were uniquely adaptable to my system, to either my taste, my cooking, my style of gardening, the climate. They particularly suited my niche, and they were not generic varieties. And so again, if I wanted to keep those going, I had to save seed from them.
So saving seed varies from crop to crop. And I know that you teach a lot of courses and you write about seed saving. So when you're thinking of talking about seed saving for beginner seed savers in our climate in the Northeast, what are some of the things that beginners need to know, and what are some of the crops that they might explore first?
Probably the most straightforward answer to that is, I would say, the crops that you're growing anyway to eat. In other words, if you're used to having this food on your table, then you should be saving seeds. A lot of people get into saving something because it's interesting to them. In order for seed saving efforts to be more sustainable, they should be yoked with your eating habits, what you're used to having on your table. Now, as you say, every crops are all different. Some are more complicated than the others. I always urge people to start off with crops which are, number one, self-pollinating. So you don't have to worry about them crossing, isolating, all those issues that come up. You can just put them all in your garden. You could have 10 varieties of beans or tomatoes all next to each other, no problem. And secondly, it's good if it's a variety which is an annual. You plant it in the spring, you harvest it in the fall, you go to Aruba for the winter, no problem, you forget about it, you're all done, as opposed to biennials and other things like that. It's good to start with things like beans and tomatoes and such simple, straightforward crops as that.
And when you're starting with seed saving, it's also important to know whether or not you're working with like an F1 hybrid versus an open pollinated crop. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's extremely important, because F1 hybrids are varieties which do not come true to type. People say you can't save seed from them. Well, technically you can save seed, but the seed will not be true to type. And one of the things that we need to know when we plant seeds, we need to have some realistic expectations of what we're going to get. We need a fair amount of uniformity and a fair amount of predictability, and that can be carried too far. But if you're planting F1 hybrid seeds, it's going to be a crapshoot. It's going to be all over the map. You have no idea what you're going to get. So one realistically can't practically save a seed for F1 hybrids, unless you're planning on being the plant breeder. which I don't think we have time to talk about today.
So assuming you have a self-pollinated annual, so say you've got an heirloom variety of beans or an heirloom variety of tomatoes that you're already growing for your own table and you want to get into seed saving, where do you start?
Yeah, and the example that you're giving, something like beans or tomatoes, are fairly straightforward because the things you have to do to save seed of those things are the things you're doing to grow them. You start the seeds, you plant them, you do all the stuff you would ordinarily do. It's just that you carry it another step further. Some of your plants, you let them go by. Now, in the case of tomatoes, you ordinarily let your tomatoes become ripe anyway. But let's say in the case of something like green beans, ordinarily you'd pick them at the green stage, which is immature. You may be growing them for green beans, but if you're saving some for seeds, then you have to let those go by. So they're useless to eat. Same thing with cucumbers, for example, and zucchini. Some of those things, the stage you eat them at, it's not their mature stage. You have to let them go sometimes much further along than that. Same thing with sweet corn and same thing with peppers. You have to let them get ripe. And then you have to harvest them and then you have to process them, which is a whole other matter.
Let's get into some of the harvesting and processing that's involved in seed saving.
Most of the things we're talking about now are kind of generic things for every crop because we don't have time to grow by crop in detail. So you harvest the fruit, let's say it's a tomato. Then you harvest the tomato. It should be ripe enough to eat, preferably. If it's overripe, past being ripe to eat, so much the better. If it's gotten again kind of soft and mushy, just means the seed is riper. And if it's just ripe when you harvest it, it's good to leave it on the windowsill maybe for a few more days to get a little overripe. That's ideal, not critical, but ideal. Then there are basically two systems of processing seeds, depending on the crop. Most are done by a dry process, where you let the plant mature and dry. It'll get all brown and yellow, and the leaves and all the parts come brittle and crispy and crumbly and all that. And those things, including the pods or the seed heads or whatever, those you harvest them, get them very, very dry, and you simply, well, we call it threshing, but in this case, it's often just rubbing them between your hands or something like that. You crush them or break them so the seeds are separate from their parts. Then you winnow them, which basically means if you're doing a small scale, you put it in a bowl and you either blow it or put it between two bowls, two buckets, and in a light breeze, so that that stuff all blows away and you end up with nothing but pure seed. The thing that makes that relatively easy is the fact that, with no exceptions that I know of, seeds are always the densest part of their respective plant. So you can count on the seeds falling down into your bowl and your other stuff blowing away. The only exception is some crops which are aerodynamically, like parsnip seeds. Even though they may be denser than the parts, because of the little flakes, they'll blow a lot. But basically, threshing and winnowing is the basic processing thing for dry crops. There's only a couple of things which have to be done by a wet process, and we're usually talking about tomatoes or cucumbers. Think of tomato seeds. They have that little kind of gooey bit around them, kind of like a frog's egg. It's the amnion. That's where a lot of nutrients are stored for the seed. But you don't want that. In fact, if you scoop those seeds out with that stuff on them and dry them that way, which many people do, they'll probably be good for maybe a year. Tomato seeds should be storable for many years. I've had tomato seeds be stored for 10 or 12 years and still be viable. But that's only if they're processed correctly. If you take those seeds and get rid of that amnion bit, then they'll keep much longer. And the other thing is, when you plant them, if they have that bit of goo on them, they'll tend to harbor spores for damping off and other diseases if you don't do that. So the way of doing that is fairly simple. You scoop out all those little guts, the cucumber seeds or the tomato seeds, into a bowl or cup and put them on ideally a nice warm, shiny window is perfect. Let them sit there and ferment. And people ask, how do I know how long to ferment? Like 2, 3 days, maybe enough, maybe not. I say the general rule is when you see little fruit flies, that's your cue that they're ready enough. Okay. So then you take those and put them in a larger container and add a whole lot of water to it. If they're clumpy at all, break it up with your fingers, slosh it around. And if you put it, I say, in a jar, for example, and you slosh it around, then the stuff will swirl around in that jar. As you watch it, you'll notice that the seeds will be tending to go to the bottom of the jar. And all the rest of the stuff, the pulpy, what was flesh and stuff, the goo, will tend to spiral to the top. And so you carefully decant that, pour that off. Being careful, don't overdo it because you may lose a lot of seeds too. But you just get, let's say, half of it gone. And then do it all over again. Add more water and do it again. Each time you're getting less and less left over and more pure seeds in the bottom. You do it enough times so what you have in the bottom is basically all pure seeds and clear water. And you pour off that clear water and then put the seeds in a strainer and press out the extra seeds, put them on a paper towel or newspaper or something to dry for several days so they're very dry. That's the wet process, and that's for basically for cukes and tomatoes.
You talked about storing it and that having effect on the shelf life of the seed. So you want your seed to be viable, definitely for the next season and beyond that. So you don't have to save seed every single year of a certain crop. So how do you store the seed for maximum viability?
We would like to have these seeds last as long as possible and be viable, and that varies terrifically from species to species. I've had beet seeds be 20 years old and germinate, incredibly enough. Dream perhaps is maybe parsnips. I keep them for 3 years, even in the ideal situation, is pushing it. I try to grow mine at every second or third year at least, which is problematic for me because I have a collection of about 80 or so parsnip varieties, and that means I need to be able to isolate, which we'll talk about later, by enough distance for at least 20 or 30 of them every year. So those are things that have very poor viability. But given whatever the viability is, to go back to your original question about how to lengthen that, the key is, first of all, the processing that we talked about before is make sure that it's done thoroughly so the seeds are thoroughly dry. The slightest bit of moisture will be bad for them. Once they're as dry as they need to be, you want to store them. There's two factors that are important for storing seeds. One is dry, and the other one is cold or cool. So the ideal would be to get them at like a very few percent moisture and store them way below freezing. That'd be ideal. That may not be practical. But the thing that's most important is dry. It'd be better to have them very dry and not so cold than to have them a little damp and colder. So once you get these things ready to store, then the usual way is to put them in a seed packet, put them in your seed drawer, and keep them until next year. If you're only doing it for a year or so, that's fine. But there's no reason why most of these things shouldn't be good for several years. If you can store them in your refrigerator, or better yet, in your freezer, then that's really ideal. They'll keep for two or three times as long as they would under ambient conditions. But here's the big caveat with that. Let's say you've got a canning jar with tomato seeds in it, and you got it in the freezer. Come getting on toward February, March, whatever, you're getting ready to take some seeds out and plant them. You take them out and set them on your kitchen table. You open the lid, you take out a pinch of seeds to plant, and then you put the lid back on and put them back in the freezer. Bad idea. You've already done serious damage to those things because it may seem like the air in your kitchen is very dry, but it's got more moisture in it than those seeds. And since they are a much lower temperature than the air temperature, then whatever dampness is going to condense on those seeds. So when you put them back away, they may look just the same. It's only been 5 or 10 minutes, but they are now significantly damper than they were when you put them in. So the remedy for that is quite simple. Take the jar out, put it on your kitchen table, and leave it there for 10 minutes or whatever, so the seeds get to be the ambient temperature. We would like to keep them cold and never bring them up to a warmer temperature, but that's much less critical than have them get moisture. It makes all the difference in the world. I've had seeds keep for 8 or 10 years, which ordinarily might be good for 2 years. If you're saving your own seeds, very likely in any given season, you're going to have much more seeds than you need next year. You're going to have enough for several years. So why not keep it for several years? And again, it's the key to that is those things I just mentioned.
You are listening to Common Ground Radio on WERU 89.9 FM. I'm Holly Cederholm, and on today's show, we're learning about seed saving in advance of MOFCA's annual seed swap and scion exchange, which will be held on Sunday, March 29th, 2026, from noon to 4 p.m. at the Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association in Unity, Maine. The event is free and open to the public. You can learn more about it by visiting MOFCA's website, mofca.org.
If you're able to keep seed for several years, you can also isolate by time. We didn't get into some of the more complicated wind or insect pollinated crops yet, but with squash, for example, you might be growing the Cucurbita pepo species and you only want to have one of those in your field at a time. So if you are able to save enough seed and freeze it, you don't necessarily have to save it year after year. So I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about how isolation plays into seed saving, because we talked about beans and tomatoes not needing it, but what about some of those crops that people need to consider isolation for?
Definitely. Let's go there now. First of all, let's make a general summary of which things need to cross-pollinate and which don't. Unfortunately, those that do cross, they're the problems, are more common. Those that are self-pollinating and therefore don't need to be isolated at all, In Maine, I generally find with peppers, some people say in some parts of the country, peppers can cross readily. Here, they do a little, but rarely. The main vector for those, in my experience, is they're not wind pollinated. They're basically pollinated by insects, in particular, bumblebees. Well, bumblebees, those big fat guys, they don't travel very far like a honeybee would. So I find 50 or 100 feet is ample to keep those separate. But some other things, the brassicas, like cabbage and kale, are pollinated by honeybees, and they can travel a long distance. Things which self-pollinate, generally, I consider beans, tomatoes, peas. Peas and beans are great that way. Tomatoes generally don't, except for so-called potato leaf varieties. A lot of the heirlooms are potato leaf varieties. They have kind of big, broad-lobed leaves, not the fine, ferny leaves. And a problem with those is because of the morphology, they can easily be cross-pollinated with other things. But most tomato varieties work just fine. They'll self-pollinate. Lettuce is good that way. Endive is good that way. They'll all self-pollinate. Most of the other things, all the cucurbits, squash, cucumbers, melons, they will all cross-pollinate within their species, which we'll say something about in a minute. Corn, of course, will. And all of the biennials that I can think of, carrots, parsnips, turnips, cabbage, kale, all those things, they'll all cross-pollinate within their species. Those are all, mostly, I think the ones I mentioned are all insect-pollinated. So that has a lot to do with how you do it. Beets and chard, on the other hand, are wind-pollinated, as is corn. So there's a lot of difference between how far pollen will travel on the wind and how far it will go on the feet of a fly, let's say, or honeybee. But if it's a cross-pollinated, we've established that in order to keep that variety true to type, then we need to keep it pure from crossing with another plant of the same species. And here's where it can get a little bit more complicated. It's important that you know that beets and Swiss chard are the same species, Beta vulgaris. We see them as two different vegetables. They see each other as bed partners. They can and will freely cross-pollinate, and you'll get something which is neither a beet nor a chard. Be very disappointing. It's also helpful to know that this can work for you. If you know that what we call the cabbage family are actually not the family, they're the same species. And I'm talking about the Brassica oleraceus. I'm talking about cabbage, kale, collards, Brussels sprouts, kohlrabi, broccoli, cauliflower. They're all the same species. So again, they will all intercross and give you some useless thing. They have to all be separated from each other. But on the other hand, what can help us if we know, for example, that squash, as you mentioned, probably the biggest group of squash that people grow in Maine is pepo, the biggest species. And that includes not only all your summer squashes, patty pan, yellow crookneck, zucchinis, those are all pepos, as are all the true pumpkins, jack-o'-lantern pumpkins, and as are a few of the things like spaghetti squash, acorn squash, and some of the gourds. Those are all pepos, and they will all cross with each other. But it's handy if you also know that most of the winter squashes, buttercup squash, Hokkaido, a lot of those types of squash, the ones that you have dry, sweet flesh, and they have a corky, knobby stem as opposed to the ridged stem that the pepo has, those are all Cucurbita maxima. And they will all cross within themselves, but they will not cross-pollinate with the pepos. And there's still a third species, and that is the butternut squashes. Those ones with a large neck, the beige-colored squashes, those are Cucurbita moschata. And they will all cross among themselves. There are several varieties of those, but they will not cross with any of the others. So that's handy, because that means in any given year, I can have in my garden one zucchini variety growing. I can have buttercup squash growing, and I can have butternut squash growing, and save seed from all of those without doing anything special, without isolating them, without hand pollinating, which is a whole other kettle of fish to deal with, and be all right. But I do not want to have in the same garden a zucchini growing and some pumpkins growing. You will end up with some really funky looking crosses of those things. So separating them by distance is probably the most straightforward way. That only works if you have enough space. You can have a garden here and another mini garden, a little seed plot, at least 100 meters away from it, but ideally further. So they're not likely to be crossed by insects going back and forth. What is enough distance depends on several factors. One is what is between those two isolations. I call them those plots isolations. If you have in between them a big hay field full of clover and all kinds of wildflowers and stuff growing, then you're in much better shape because by the time, let's say, a honeybee goes back and forth from one isolation to the hive and back to the hive and back to the hive and gets to the other isolation, he'll basically have shed all of that pollen behind pretty much. As opposed to if you've got two isolations and between them you have a paved parking lot. As soon as he gets done at one isolation, goes to the other, there's much more chance of crossing. Another factor is how much purity do you absolutely have to have? Because if you have two extremely rare varieties, which is often the case with me, but not with most gardeners, you have two varieties, you're the last person on the planet that has them, they're going to go extinct, and you have to keep them very pure. Well, then you're really the surest way of doing it is to put one isolation, one in growing in your garden, and the other one on Venus. That's the extreme case. Somewhere in between them, maybe you have two varieties of carrots, which you're saving, for example, and they're both wonderful varieties. Let's say you've got red cord Chardonnay and scarlet Nance. And a cross of those, if you did get a cross, not the end of the world. I assume it's going to be a pretty elegant variety, even if they do cross. But most importantly, those varieties are both carried by a lot of seed companies. So if and when you do get one crossed up and you decide I got to get some fresh seed, no big deal. Again, if you have some variety that's very rare and you can't go back and get, then your restraints are much tighter. So that's using distance to keep things pure. But the other one that you were alluding to is using time. One of the methods that some people use, it's recommended, but I don't think in Maine it's very practical, is staggering your plantings within the season. For example, if you've got two corn varieties, plant one very early corn, another one mid-season, so that their pollen shed time hopefully doesn't overlap. Maine, we have a shorter season. I think it's very problematic to do that. You're going to very likely have some overlap. I don't recommend it. But you can have different things in different years. And again, it's important that the seed is viable for much more than 1 year. We mentioned those two carrot varieties. Let's say every year I grow both varieties in my garden to eat because I love them both. But I only save seed of, in other words, overwintering one variety and letting it make flower stalks the second year because they're biennials. I only do that this year with my scarlet Nance. And I'll get enough seed from it for the next 3, 4, 5 years. And next year I'll grow it to eat, but I won't save any seed. Next year I'll only save the red cord Chardonnay seed. And by a strategy like that, not only can one person save more variety, but we can have a community strategy. For example, you and I, Holly, could, let's say we both love that variety. We're both going to grow them, we're going to eat them, but you take care of the scarlet Nance, and I'll do the red cord Chardonnay, whether we do it every year or whatever. The key to that thing is I've got to know that I can trust you, and you've got to know that you can trust me. Am I competent? Maybe I don't know the fact that your garden is surrounded by Queen Anne's lace or wild carrot, or you don't have a good place of storing things. We have to know that about each other. So basically, we're acting like a mini seed company. And those can be very good strategies, not only for maintaining a larger number of varieties, but keeping a larger population size. If we want to keep the whole entirety of that variety, all the germplasm, we'd like to have a fairly large number of plants to save seed of. Otherwise, you get inbreeding. So that kind of a strategy can help with that.
Another strategy that's sometimes used are physical isolations. And you mentioned that carrots have a wild relative, Queen Anne's lace, that could make it quite challenging to have a purity condition for growing carrots. So are there physical barriers that are employed for seed saving? And what are some examples of those? I'm thinking of like exclusion netting for insects.
Like caging, for example.
Correct.
Okay, good. Now, yeah, that's very possible to do. It's another step higher. I certainly would not recommend it for beginners, but the strategy I've often used with my scatter seed project, there was 1 year I had, I think it was at least 20 varieties that I grew the year before, and they're biennials, which means that I grew the root this year and overwinter them, and next year I've got to plant them back out. Now, the first year of the year I'm planting them, there's no sex going on. It's just a vegetative part. I haven't got to worry about it. I can grow them all in my little garden, just like in the same plot. But by the second year, when I take them out of my root cellar and replant them, I need to have them in isolated plots, each one so many feet apart. Well, let's say that year I didn't have 20 isolated plots available. So the other strategy I went with caging. I made a lot of cages with just wooden framing and nylon or aluminum window screening covering them. And each one is big enough to have, I don't know, 20 or 30 plants, which is a minimum in it. That works very nicely in one respect. It keeps all the natural ambient pollinators out, all the surface flies and honeybees and stuff. They can't get into that cage. As long as they keep that cage tight, then they can't get in. So every seed that forms in there will be pure. The problem is most of those biennial species are what we call obligate outcrosses. In other words, they're self-sterile. They can't pollinate themselves, even if there's two blossoms on the same plant. Even though most of those species have what we call perfect blossoms. So for as far as that goes, you think, well, then therefore I can have just one plant and they can pollinate themselves. But they generally will not. There's kind of a built-in biological mechanism that they will not accept their own pollen. They themselves know how to prevent inbreeding. And so in a case like that, on the one hand, you need more than one plant to get any seed at all. But who's going to be the vector? What's going to carry the pollen from one plant to the other if you've kept all the flies, bees, and things out of there? Plant breeders sometimes do this with like a Q-tip or a paintbrush. That makes the seed very expensive, like a buck per seed or something. But the practical way to do it is to introduce pollinators. And I get mine from an insectary company in Ventura, California. You can order them and they come parcel post in a little styrofoam packet. And they're very cheap, like $25 for 500 or a couple thousand, whatever. Maggots. What you're getting is maggots. Hey, this is America. You can buy anything. And they come second day of air, and you put some of those in that cage, and they hatch out, and they'll do the pollinating. That works. There's a lot of more tricks than I'm mentioning here. It basically works fine. You can do it, but if you can avoid that, I'd urge you to save that for you to get much more into this.
Yeah, definitely a more advanced method. So circling back to just seed saving more generally, you mentioned at the top of the show that you like saving seed for selecting plants that fit better into your system. If you're noticing traits like earliness or flavor, so I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how selection work comes into seed saving work.
Yeah. And selection, to quote the bumper sticker, selection happens. Whether you select or Mother Nature selects. Some plants are going to overwinter better in your garden than if you had a garden in Maryland or something, where the climate is different, where the pests are different. So that itself, what kind of a year it is, hot year, dry year, whatever, some varieties, they're selected anyway, whether you select them or not. So it's really good to have some idea in your mind. The more precise, the better, but still, it's got to have a good idea of what you're looking for and what you're selecting for. It's also important to know what that variety is distinguished by. For example, take, let's say, some Amsterdam forcing carrots, those little crisp little salad carrots, and you get a whole bunch of you grow them, you want to save seed from them, and you dig them up and you lay them out and you look at them, say, oh my goodness, this one's much bigger than the others. I'm going to save seeds of that and use that. And now you're being a plant breeder, and you may be doing exactly what you want, or you may be doing exactly what you don't want, because very likely that larger carrot is going to give you much later seeds. Later carrots and not the crisp, tender thing we want for a salad or whatever. So know what you're looking for. Also, select by the whole plant. Sometimes someone may look at a row of tomato plants and say, this one here has got one tomato on it that's earlier than all of the rest of them. The others have come along behind it, but this is the first one. So if I save seeds from that, won't I get earlier tomatoes? Not necessarily. Look at the whole plant, because maybe that's got one by a fluke, one very early one, the rest of them are weeks away from maturity. And then some other plant in that row that where none of them are ready quite yet, but they're all coming along very quickly. So you've got to consider the entire plant, not just an individual fruit, because the tomatoes on that plant are basically all going to have those same characteristics, whether they manifest it equally or not.
This has been Common Ground Radio, which airs on the second Thursday of each month at 4 p.m. on WERU Community Radio. Archives of previous episodes can be found on WERU.org as well as the WERU app. Stay tuned for more great programming.